Iran fires a regional Islamist official after an online video purportedly shows him having sex with another man. We ask VOA's Persian service why the scandal is generating consternation.
We have a 45 years history that the Iranian regime says something and do completely opposite of it.
Plus, Iran responds to the U.S. sending more warships to the region by showing off a new long-range missile. A Washington-based analyst tells us why the U.S. should be concerned.
Iran wants to make sure that these aircraft carriers are based or stationed as far away as possible from their territorial waters.
And we look at why Iran's minorities make up so many of the protesters killed by Iranian security forces over the past year. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Many Iranians are in uproar after an online video was published last month purportedly showing an Islamist official in Iran's northern province of Gilan having sex with another man. Iranian authorities fired the official, Reza Zaghati, and promised to investigate shortly after a Germany-based Iranian journalist posted the video on Telegram on July 19th. Zaghati had been in charge of locally enforcing the mandatory veiling of women, an Islamist dress code deeply resented by secular Iranians. Iranian parliament member Morteza Mahmoudvand later told state-approved news site Iran Watch that he knew about the video before its publication and had urged Iran's culture minister Mohammad Mehdi Esmaili to do something about it. Esmaili responded by telling another news site that he had not seen any negative reports about Zaghati before the video appeared online. I sat down in our studio with VOA Persian's Ali Sajadi and asked him what more is known about Zaghati, the man at the center of the scandal.
Well, Reza Zaghati is a man in his early 40s and a revolutionary person. He was the head of the so-called morality police, or the head of the office who was overseeing the promoting Islamic value in Gilan, which is one of the provinces in north of Iran.
So an influential guy, but now he's in trouble, isn't he? So what do we know about his current situation?
Well, we don't know anything for fact because the Islamic Republic is very quiet about it and try to hush-hush things, don't talk about it. But they are reporting that he is under arrest and he's in jail with some other people, including some of his victims that they say is up to 7 or 8 young men.
So there is another key figure in this story, and that is Peyman Behbodi, who is an Iranian living in Germany, running a Telegram channel called Radio Gilan. And he is the one who actually published images, allegedly, of Zaghati engaging in this sexual behavior. And he's threatened to publish more images. What do we know about him?
Well, we know that he left Iran a few years ago, and he's running that radio, you said, Radio Gilan, that focused on the issues of that province. He himself is from Gilan. He has a history of working as a journalist, and his reporting on the other issues in Gilan are pretty impressive.
So he has a good track record.
I think he has, yes.
He said that he received the video from one of the people who allegedly had sex with Zaghati, and
yes.
He's also talked about what allegedly happened inside Iran. Before he published this video, he was talking about how the video was known to officials in the Islamic Republic. There were talks about what to do about it, and nothing was done. Zaghati stayed in his position. How are you able in VOA Persian to try to verify what Behbodi is saying?
Well, first of all, as you said, he has a good track as a journalist. And then we also had a disclaimer that we cannot independently verify this video. And by the way, we did not broadcast the video. We just had the news and talked
right
to Peyman. So that's that. But the fact of matter is that this guy, Segati, was removed after the publishing this video on social media. Mm-hmm. So that's a hint that might be a correct, a valid, authentic video.
Why has VOA Persian been covering these developments so closely?
Well, because it shows one of the biggest hypocrisy of the Islamic Republic. Okay, if two men, two grown-up men, want to sleep with each other or have sex or whatever, relationship, love, whatever you call it, it is not news. But when one of them is an official promoting so-called Islamic value...
Which is what Segati was doing.
Which is what Segati was doing. And in his private, he's doing something with entirely against that values. Then it is a news. That's one angle to look at it. The other thing is, if they are, or if their partner are the kids under age, it is definitely a news, because this is fall in the rape category. We had another example a few years ago, Said Toussi, that he allegedly raped seven kids.
And who was Said Toussi, just for our audience?
Said Toussi was a reciter of Quran in the office of Khamenei.
Very important person.
Very important person, yeah. A top reciter of Holy Book.
What happened to him?
Well, they got him to the judiciary. There was court for him, but he was not convicted. And for some reason, a judge decided that he let him go.
We'll have to see what happens in the case of Segati, who was fired and apparently is facing some kind of investigation.
We have to wait and see. But I think they're most probably they're trying not to bring it into the light or to the public.
Well, it's embarrassing, isn't it?
It's very embarrassing. It's really, especially for an official who is going here and there and say kids or girls cannot have walking without hijab, or if their hair is out, then there is a movie, there is a film that he has sex with another man. Of course it is.
What can you share about the reactions of your audience to all this news?
They were not surprised. You know, we have a history of 45 years history that the Iranian regime say something and do completely opposite of it. You know, they're talking about peace, yet they're waging war. You know, it is something that everybody understand that. And I don't think most people surprised about it. The people who were surprised, they were religious people. You know, the religious people, those people who are following the government or believe in the government, I hear that many of them are under shock of this news.
That makes sense. They would be very surprised.
Very surprised for them, yes.
Ali Sajadi, managing editor for VOA Persian, great to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
Iran's naval forces unveiled a new fleet of homegrown cruise missiles last week with a declared range of 1,000 kilometers. Tehran said the Abu Mahdi missile is guided by artificial intelligence and can evade radar at low altitudes to destroy warships at sea. Days earlier, the U.S. announced its latest deployment of warships and fighter jets to the Middle East in recent weeks to deter Iran from aggressive acts such as trying to seize commercial vessels in the Persian Gulf. Farzin Nadimi is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, specializing in Iran's military affairs. I asked him what message Iran is trying to send by showing off the new cruise missile.
Well, I think that it is an indirect response by Iran to those deployments. And Iran, they announced the intention of using these missiles against any nation that attempted any attack against Iran's territorial integrity and sovereignty. These missiles have a range of over 1,000 kilometers, and they can be fired from either shore or inland mobile firing units, or they can be fired from their ships. Well, so far, we do not have any known Iranian vessels that can carry and fire this specific kinds of cruise missiles, but they have been talks and they have been assessment that the IRGC's most recent Catamaran missile boats, they can carry some kind of cruise missile with long ranges. And also the Iranian sea-basing vessels, Macron, for example, they do have suspicious containers on their deck, which can be modified to carry cruise missiles.
But what I want to know is, how much of a threat do you think those capabilities that you just described would be to U.S. forces in the area?
Well, one very reason that they are going to deploy these missiles is to push the U.S. aircraft carriers in the similar capabilities like this amphibious ready groups further away from Iran, probably to as far as 2,000 kilometers or nautical miles, because these missiles, as I mentioned, can be carried on board naval vessels. So they want to push them as far away that their air assets would not be effective enough. However, we know that any air assets on board these aircraft carriers can still be deployed to shore bases, or they can use aerial refueling to extend their range. And that effectively makes them, in terms of range, unlimited range. But Iran still wants to make sure that these aircraft carriers are based or stationed as far away as possible from their territorial waters. These missiles can serve that purpose. They also can be delivered to terrorist groups like Hezbollah. And with the help of Iranians in Syria, they can target shipping in the Mediterranean, for example. They can also be deployed on board unsuspicious commercial shipping tankers, as I mentioned, on a specially designed and modified container on board a container ship. And they can launch attacks against high-value sea or land targets very far away from Iranian land.
So when you look at the latest U.S. military assets that have been deployed, the naval assets, the fighter jets, how do you think those would be effective in dealing with the Iranian military presence in the area?
That's a very good question. The U.S. has quite a number of bases in the region that house squadrons, intelligence gathering, and tankers, transport, and some combat aircraft. And some time ago, the U.S. Air Force deployed a squadron of 18 Warthog attack aircraft to United Arab Emirates, and they are armed with small diameter bombs that are very effective against lightly defended, lightly hardened shore defenses. They have a Gatling gun, which is perfect against boat swarms. However, they are almost defenseless against highly capable air defenses, and IRGC has deployed several new assets that are basically air defense speedboats with long-range air defense systems, and to take care of them and also to take care of Iran's air defense network, which overlooks the Strait of Hormuz. They need more capable assets like F-16s and F-35s. F-35s are some of the best options to counter, to detect and track and counter air defense systems. And I think one of the main reasons of deploying in a squadron of 35s to Al-Zafra Air Base is to counter Iranian air defenses. Also, they have been deploying Arleigh Burke-class destroyers to the region, including the USS Thomas Hodner, which is a fourth-generation ballistic missile defense destroyer with both standard SM-3 missiles that are capable of engaging short-range ballistic missiles outside the atmosphere, and SM-6 dual-1 missiles that can counter short and medium-range ballistic missiles in the terminal phase inside the atmosphere. But the more important capability of this fourth-generation destroyer that is being deployed to the region is that it can engage both air and missile threats at the same time. That's unlike the USS Fowler, which was a second-generation BMD Aegis. This new warship is perfect against Iran's saturated attack scenarios, which is attacking their enemies with both drones, missiles, and air assets. So they can engage all these threats at the same time, and they can lead or coordinate a regional air defense, a very good assets to counter any saturated attack by Iran's drones and missiles and cruise missiles at the same time. These are very capable, and the Bataan Amphibious Ready Group is recently certified for special operations, and they have a special marine unit that they are specialized in retrieving downed air crews, that if they need to launch an airstrike inside Iran, they'd lose an aircraft, they need to retrieve pilots, that they really need this.
Well, Farzin Nedimi, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking to us on the line from Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The International Women's Media Foundation has honored female Iranian photojournalist Yalda Moiri with its annual award for journalists who are unjustly jailed, detained, or imprisoned. The 41-year-old Moiri was arrested last year for covering anti-government protests in Tehran and released on bail in December. She now awaits a summons to start serving a 6-year prison term on anti-state charges. IWMF Executive Director Elisa Liz Munoz spoke last week to journalist Carmela Caruso about why the organization picked Moiri for its Wallace Annenberg Justice for Women Award.
Her case stood out to us because of the situation in Iran and the protests. But in particular, we wanted to bring attention to the fact that Iran is the biggest jailer of women journalists in the world. And we feel that the targeting of women journalists is being overlooked because it is being addressed as part of this overall oppression of women in Iran. When many of these women journalists are being targeted and imprisoned because they are covering the women's protests. And we feel that the distinction here is absolutely critical, that these women are being targeted because of their work and because they're women, not necessarily because they are participating in part of a public protest. And in Yalda's case in particular, she was covering the protests. And so we believe that that is a significant distinction and that it's important to point out that among the targeting of women, Iran is taking advantage of this situation to also imprison women who are inconveniently reporting on what's going on.
That was IWMF Executive Director Elisa Liz Munoz. The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran has reported that ethnic and religious minorities who have long suffered discrimination in the country are grossly overrepresented in the numbers of those killed by the government's crackdown on protests that erupted last September. Speaking virtually to a gathering of the Washington-based Atlantic Council on July 20th, Javaid Rehman said more than half of those killed since the start of the protests were Baluchis and Kurds. One activist who attended the gathering was Shaheen Milani, executive director of U.S. nonprofit group Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. In the second part of my sit-down interview with Milani, I asked why Baluchis and Kurds accounted for so many victims of the crackdown.
So that's a question that I would like to explore. There are some possible explanations. For one thing, the regime takes a heavier hand towards minorities, ethnic minorities, and Sunnis. It feels that it has a freer hand. Just killing about 100 people in one day in Zahedan, if it had done the same thing in Tehran, the implications of it internationally would have been much more pronounced.
What about even domestically?
Even domestically, probably so, because if you kill 100 people in Tehran in one day, it's a different story. Something like that happening in the capital. They've killed a lot of people in the capital too as well. Don't get me wrong. But just on one day, just shooting and just mowing down people like that, not that they wouldn't do it in Tehran if they had to, but it's much easier for them, I believe, in Zahedan.
Perhaps easier, but it hasn't been the case that we've seen repeats of that specifically brutal day last September in Zahedan. There hasn't been another mass shooting incident like that in terms of Iranian security forces gunning down
Baluchis. So how can you explain why, even if they thought it was easy to do that back then, they haven't done it again?
Well, you know, I can get into the heads of the Iranian officials and why exactly they shoot on one day and they don't shoot the other. If they feel that it's necessary, they would do it. Probably my guess is that they haven't felt that it was necessary. This was the beginning of the process, so I think maybe they wanted to draw a line and send a message that, you know, we're ready to kill. But what I want to draw the attention of your audience to is that while this revolution has been dubbed, woman life freedom revolution, and there's been a lot of focus on particularly young women who were killed, and we know their names, and their stories have been, you know, well reported in media, there are just these hundreds of other victims whose stories we don't know and whose names we don't know. And just look at the proportions of the people who were killed. People in Zahedan and also in Kurdish provinces in the West, they've been disproportionately affected by these policies of the regime. And that's something that, you know, we have to talk about.
I thought it was interesting that in the discussion we had today here at the Atlantic Council, there are other minority ethnic linguistic groups in Iran that also have suffered long persecution in the Islamic Republic, but we didn't see them come out and demonstrate as much, perhaps, and we certainly didn't see them get attacked and killed as much by the Iranian security forces in the protests that started last year. Why is that?
Well, I would say that the minorities that happen to be Sunni, they've been subject to a lot more discrimination than others.
You have the Ahvazi Arabs in southwest Iran, and because they're Shia, mostly, this kind of immunizes them, perhaps?
No, it doesn't immunize them. There's been, for example, in November 2019, one of the bloodiest events of that protest happened in the town of Mahshah, where, you know, machine guns were used to kill a lot of protesters, and we don't know exactly the number. So, no, it doesn't immunize a certain group of people. With respect to Ahvazi Arabs, too, the regime has shown a lot of brutality when it feels it's necessary. But again, Ahvazi Arabs, I think the majority of them are Shia. So while there are a lot of problems in the region and they suffer from economic inequality, they're not religious minorities per se, when, you know, the Kurds and Kurdistan province and the Baluchis are. So, you know, that's a long-standing issue. And, you know, in this recent events, of course, Mahsa Jina, I mean, he was from Kurdistan, she was from Saqqez, so naturally people in that region were probably more likely to come to take to the streets. And in Zahedan, there was also a concurring case of a woman who was allegedly raped by the authorities, so there was
another grievance that the locals had.
Yeah, led to the discontent and led to the people coming to the streets. So, you know, we have those factors. You have to take those factors into consideration as well. But again, I think the religious aspect is really important. And also just the very fact of being in the periphery of the country and not having that much access to the source of power, to media.
Perhaps makes them easier targets.
Yes. I mean, in Tehran, a lot of people in Tehran have even relatives or friends who live in the West. And if they were killed on that scale, you would have a lot more of an international outcry and outrage, as opposed to people in Zahedan, who just are in the periphery of a power structure. And they don't have access to media or don't have relatives who, you know, work in big corporations in the West who, you know, could raise their profile.
Well, Shaheen Milani, Executive Director of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, speaking to us here at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.